Troy Coleman split his formative years between California and the middle-class Philadelphia neighborhood of Mount Airy. But while in Philly, he attended a rough high school in Germantown, where he met Byron Johnson, Kareem Nobles, and Darren Keith Johnson. After Troy graduated, Byron and Kareem were the muscle behind a cocaine operation that they all ran out of Troy's apartment. However, a drug drought in the summer of 1989 stimulated desperate behavior all over Philly. And while Troy was away in Atlantic City on September 26, 1989, Kareem allegedly set up a deal with two men, Kevin Jones and Arthur Sanders. Now, according to Sanders, he waited down the block while Kevin Jones drove to Troy's apartment in his gray Dodge with $40,000 to buy cocaine. Nearly 2 hours later, Sanders claimed to see two other men driving away in Kevin Jones's gray Dodge, a light-skinned driver and a darker-skinned passenger wearing a hat with the brim pulled down low. Kevin's body was eventually found in the gray Dodge. Sanders agreed that Troy's photo looked like the passenger. With Sanders' shaky ID and the coerced and incentivized testimony of Darren Keith Johnson, Troy was sentenced to life in prison. Despite Darren's 1998 recantation and Byron Johnson's 2019 confession to being the actual passenger in the gray Dodge that day, Troy continues to serve life for a crime for which he was not even in Philadelphia to commit. This is Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. That's me. And today we have a story that I think is going to rock your world in a different kind of way, right? Because the person that we're interviewing today, Troy Coleman, has been incarcerated for 31 years in Pennsylvania for a crime he didn't commit. That being said, he wasn't a choir boy. Some of the people we have on the show were literal choir people before they were arrested. But he is innocent of this crime. He wasn't even in the same city when it happened, or state for that matter. So Troy's on the phone from prison. Troy, I'm glad you're here, but I'm sorry you have to be here under these circumstances.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And with Troy is Jerry Brown, not the former governor of California, but an esteemed attorney from Philadelphia. Thank you for joining us on the show today.
Jason, my pleasure.
Let's go back, Troy. You grew up in a middle-class environment, right?
Yes, I did. I grew up in Mount Airy, Philadelphia, which is a middle-class neighborhood, and I was blessed to live with my grandmother, who was well off, and we had a beautiful home, three-bedroom home, and, you know, everyone who came from that home came to be very successful. All of them went to private school, even my father, and my father moved to California, and when he moved to California, I was going back and forth from California to Philadelphia from my grandmother's house, which California school curriculum, our junior high curriculum was equal to a high school curriculum here in Philadelphia. But, you know, when I came back to high school here in Philadelphia, Germantown High School, I was looked at as kind of nerdy, I guess, you know, because of the academics, I guess, that we came with versus what was over here in Philadelphia. And, you know, you try your best to fit in and you want to be accepted. That's where a lot of my demise came from, when I got involved with drugs, not needing to, didn't have to. You know, again, my family was well-to-do. However, you know, just to fit in and be a part of this particular neighborhood that was in Germantown, which is a little bit, wasn't a good lifestyle that they lived down there. It was a little more lower class. Again, I'm from Mount Airy, so when I started boxing at the age of 13, being down there in the gym, that's how I met a couple of them guys from around that neighborhood. After that, subsequently, I got involved with them about the age of 17, 16. We started out young on the corners. So that's when it began.
So this must have put you on the radar of the local police. And we know that in that time and place, this was a culture that had started with Frank Rizzo, who as the police chief in Philadelphia from 68 to 71. The legacy of brutality and corruption is widely known, and it thrived in the police department after he became mayor. It's really crazy that that guy became mayor, but 72 to 80, and they were just beating the shit out of everybody back then. And it's really... It's crazy that this was a major American city So, Jerry, you were a college student at the University of Pennsylvania at that time, and you experienced or were at least aware of this, right? This is not hyperbole, right?
Oh, no. If you had a little bit of long hair like I did, you, every time you walked down the street at night, you were afraid that you were going to get stopped and hassled by the police. And I'm sure for people of color, it was much worse.
In my research, I mean, these were in the 39th District, right? A section of North Philadelphia, which was a working class, poor black neighborhood. Police routinely made false arrests, planted drugs, robbed victims, and filed bogus reports to cover up their actions. So all of this is known now. It's been documented. This is not us just having a this is a trip down a very ugly memory lane right here.
In fact, there were 1,400 convictions that were overturned due to the 39th District. But they're not the only ones. There was the one squad cases, the five squad cases. I mean, there's been a history in Philadelphia. You know, and then in the 90s, you have one of the cops that was involved in this case, Martin Devlin. A number of cases have been overturned because of him. It's a very sordid history.
Right. So this, of course, brings me back to another person who was wrongfully convicted who's been on our show, Tony Wright, which was ironically the same cop that was involved in Troy's case, Martin Devlin. And in the article in Rolling Stone magazine about Tony's case, there was a pull quote that said that in the 1980s or 90s, a black man had a better chance of getting justice in Philadelphia, Mississippi than in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So let's go to that. And of course, Troy, this, of course, what led up to this, I think indirectly, is the fact that you were involved, as you've been very honest about, in the cocaine business. Can you tell us about that and the people that were working under you at the time, because they come to play a role in your wrongful conviction?
Well, when we got involved, it was a couple guys from that neighborhood, particularly down Croson Street. And this is, they're actually called the Jungle. Some of the guys that's involved, Byron Johnson, Darren Keith Johnson, Raymond Nobles, and his street name was Kareem. My street name at the time was Kasim with an S. His was with R, his was Kareem. So he was an older guy. He just got out of jail, did all this time. Everybody looked up to him as the tough guy and so on and so forth. To me, it was like imperative that I get him involved, and somewhat for the muscle as well as Byron.
So you had Byron Johnson, Darren Johnson, and Kareem Nobles were your underlings. They worked for you.
Yes. I guess my little intellect being involved in that allowed me to shoot up fast. So I had a little apartment down in Bar Street. Pulaski Town is what they call that. But we had an apartment in Pulaski Town. That was just for, you know, fun dealing with the drug stuff, girls and all that. The Raymond Nobles, Kareem was actually staying in my apartment while I lived in Mount Airy. I still had that place, and Byron had keys to the apartment, Kareem had keys to the apartment. So people had access to it. At that time, I was driving BMWs, had a nice amount of money, and I was okay. However, these guys that were working for me, they were okay until a drought came in 1989. A drought is when there's no drugs, particularly cocaine, available at that time in the city where it could be purchased and sold. And this was a well-known time because the homicide rate rose significantly at that time, and it was real bad. So when this drought came about, I was okay. These guys, I didn't have anything for them. So they actually ran amok, for lack of a better phrase. They just ran amok. They was just doing all kinds of crazy stuff. And this day in particular in which this crime happened, myself and another gentleman by the name of Richard Crawford, that morning of September 26th, we went to Atlantic City. And when I was in Atlantic City, I think I had no more than 9 ounces of cocaine left. And I actually, you know, trusted Kareem to deal with that while I was gone. And when I left on the 26th, we get to Atlantic City that morning, was gambling, taking in sights, you know, shopping, talking, all that other stuff to girls, whatever. So I was very intoxicated. I wasn't willing to drive back to the city. So that night, we checked into a hotel.
Okay, so you were in Atlantic City having fun, intoxicated, so drunk, in fact, that you had a hard time even remembering which hotel you had checked into and under what name. And the crazy thing is that the state eventually used your own shaky memory to impeach you. But it's so twisted because they actually presented evidence that was exculpatory because it differed from your memory, that you had in fact stayed at Bally's under your own name. I mean, after all, why let evidence of you being in Atlantic City get in the way of prosecuting a man we now know, and I think they knew back then, was innocent. That should have been the end of this podcast right there, but it's not. So the crime itself, back at the apartment in Philadelphia on September 26th, 1989, Kareem set up a deal with Kevin Jones and Arthur Sanders. According to Sanders, he and Kevin Jones arrived in the area of the apartment in separate cars around 1:30 p.m. with $40,000 to buy cocaine. Now, Arthur Sanders mentioned at the first preliminary hearing of this trial that he was going to buy this cocaine from Kareem. Not Troy or your street name, Kasim, but Kareem, which is why this case was initially thrown out as it should have been. But nonetheless, here we are all these years later. So again, according to Sanders, Jones continued down the street in a gray Dodge alone while Sanders waited down the block. Then about an hour and a half later, Sanders allegedly saw two men driving the gray Dodge past him, a light-skinned man driving and a darker-skinned man with the brim of his hat pulled down low in the passenger seat. That night, the Jones family came to Troy's apartment armed, looking for Kevin Jones. They threatened Troy's girlfriend. The apartment was searched, but alas, no Kevin. So at this point, Troy, you didn't know it yet, but you were in a lot of trouble. And I don't mean with the cops. The cops actually kind of inadvertently saved you.
When I got back to Philadelphia that next day, I was stopped by the police. You know, I had my license and registration. Everything was legit. But they found a bag of marijuana in the car. And that might have been a good thing because I got arrested that evening. And when I called home, and that's when I heard everything. Everybody saying, yeah, these guys are looking for you. If you stayed there, they want to kill you. So when I was bailed out, my girlfriend at the time, as well as my mother, had bags in the car and a ticket for me. And that's that very next day, I was in California.
Okay, so even though you had nothing to do with this, you had to leave town just to be safe in California, at least for now. And at this point, the cops aren't even involved yet. And we find out much later that Kareem, of course, Kareem was Raymond Nobles, killed Kevin Jones and got Byron Johnson to help him dispose of the body. These are the two men that Arthur Sanders allegedly saw rolling by him in the gray Dodge. But we don't find that out until much later. Now, between the time of this crime and when it's investigated, Kareem, Raymond Nobles, died. Now, call me crazy, but it just might have been the Joneses had something to do with that. So anyway, now, November 21st, 1989, the police discovered Kevin Jones's body in the trunk of the gray Dodge in the John Wanamaker parking lot in Abingdon Township. The body was bound with electrical cord, blankets, sheets, and some insulation. By that time, it was badly decomposing, but it's clear that his face had been struck with a blunt object several times, and then one, and this is important, one hard contact, high-velocity gunshot wound was the cause of death. And we'll get to why that's important later. So anyway, the investigation begins, and initially, after being pressured by both the Jones family and the notoriously corrupt detective Martin Devlin, Arthur Sanders implicated Troy.
According to him, he'd never seen Troy before, and he's sitting there waiting for an hour and a half. Suddenly, a car comes by. Now, just logically, when you think about it, if suddenly you see a car, first of all, you go, you know, that car looks familiar. And then in your mind, you go, oh, yeah, that looks like it's Kevin's car. And then he looks at the driver and says, that's not Kevin, it's a light-skinned guy. And then he looks at the passenger who has his hat over his head, and he's able to identify him. Now, all this is happening in 2 or 3 seconds, according to Sanders' testimony.
Officer Sanders said that the passenger was a brown skin. He said he had a baseball cap on, pulled down over his forehead, slouched in the seat. And in a photo where he said, I look like the passenger, putting me in the city at the time. However, I'm in Atlantic City. That's an impossible identification of me.
So the inference I would take is that I'm sure somebody in the police department, and Devlin certainly was willing to do something like this to create false evidence, because he's done it on multiple occasions, as you all know, and there's other cases that you didn't mention that I'm aware of. So he probably said, isn't this the guy? And, you know, Sanders is pretty scared to death anyway, because the family is really upset with him.
this is an element that's not unwilling to use gunplay if necessary. That's kind of the background of all this, and part of the reason why Arthur Sanders' statement is so flaky, if you will. He's being pressured by the police to give up somebody on the one hand. He's being pressured by the family on the other. And, you know, he says, yeah, that looks like the guy. Now that they are focusing on Troy Coleman, they start to focus in on his associates, one of whom is Darren Keith Johnson, who was a 18-year-old, 5'3", 125-pound, soaking wet youth, essentially, who's brought into homicide and who first says, I don't know anything about anything. And then they proceed to scare the hell out of him by saying, we know you do. And the homicide cops pressured him to give a statement. They told him that if he didn't give a statement, that he was going to go to jail, that he wouldn't see his mother again. I'm sure they told him that if he went to prison, that he would be molested there because he was so small. They told him that they didn't want the dead guy, Kareem Nobles. Detective Cohen said, we think that he was involved, but we want Troy because this apartment was rented by Troy. So he's scared to death, and he finally gives up Troy. Darren Johnson says, yeah, Troy admitted to me he had to lay somebody down. Those two pieces of evidence, Arthur Sanders' sort of ID and Darren Johnson, now they have enough to get an arrest warrant.
And this is from Darren Johnson's statement about what Troy allegedly told him. And now I'm going to quote, okay, ready? Quote, I had to lay somebody down over some drugs. Let me tell you how I did it. I put my gun up to him and told him to give it up. I shot him, 2 to the head, end quote. How would I know? But it sure sounds like it might have been written by somebody other than the person who was saying it. Okay, and I'll let your imagination take it from there. Now, not only is this statement not specific to the victim, Kevin Jones, but it also has a very important hallmark of false statements, which is factually inaccurate information. As I mentioned earlier, Kevin Jones was shot once, according to the medical examiner at trial, not twice. And from what I understand, they used both the carrot and the stick to get this statement from Darren. And subsequently, and this will surprise exactly no one in our audience, he received leniency for multiple drug charges. And this quid pro quo and the fact that it was hidden from the defense is something that Troy litigated through pro se post-conviction motions, but unfortunately to no avail. But the point ends up being moot here, as Darren Keith Johnson has signed multiple affidavits starting in 1998 to recant his testimony, for which the prosecutor not only threatened him with perjury, but we find out later that Darren and his mother received ominous threats from the police to stick to the original statement. However, back in 1990, with Arthur Sanders and Darren Johnson, they moved forward with your arrest, Troy, and on to what ends up being a really interesting preliminary hearing.
Yes, it was. It was murder, robbery, conspiracy, and possession of an instrument of crime. The preliminary hearing was April 12, 1990. And at this preliminary hearing, Arthur Sanders, rightfully, I guess he slipped up because he said that we were going to see Kareem. And this is throughout the preliminary hearing that we were going to see Kareem. Kareem is Raymond Nobles. My name was not mentioned.
Which is probably why Judge Merriweather, who was a decent judge, decided to dismiss the case. Because if you're going to see Kareem, that's not him.
Right. Sanders accidentally told the truth, even though he had been pressured to lie. But they're not nearly done with you yet.
So after Judge Merriweather dismissed the case, then it was about a week or two, and they rearrested me again with the same exact information in. They switched the judges and they put it before another man. I think his name was Judge Ivins, and he held it over for trial.
And it may have ended in a not guilty verdict if you hadn't been screwed over by Ed Geiger, a private investigator who your own family had hired. He was supposed to go down to Atlantic City and gather your alibi defense, but instead, we now believe that he never went to Atlantic City or spoke with Richard Crawford, your alibi witness. Otherwise, he would have found out what the state had already discovered, that you stayed at Bally's under your own name. Geiger, on the other hand, came back with no alibi evidence and told you that your alibi witness, Richard Crawford, wasn't willing to testify on your behalf. But you don't fully get this picture until 2009, though. So at trial, You just have your fuzzy, drunken memory of AC. You thought that you had stayed at the Ridgemont Inn under the name Robert Irving. So when the state presents Marlene Smith, a Bally's clerk who testified to you staying at Bally's under your own name, it actually hurt your credibility and put your rock-solid alibi on shaky ground. Then the state presents police chemist Louis Joka, who testified that the bedding, electrical cord, and insulation that Jones was wrapped in matched items from the apartment, which just established the setting of the crime, but doesn't necessarily implicate you, Troy. So what was presented at trial that convinced the jury that they should find you guilty of second-degree murder, which, of course, they ended up doing?
Well, I believe it was the testimony of Derrick and Johnson, coupled with the testimony of Arthur Sanders. However, one of the things that was said in closing was that testimony, page 751 by the prosecutor, he said, if in fact Troy was in Atlantic City and you believe that he was still involved or he put these guys up to it, then this is it. This is something that was said to the jury. You can find him guilty of conspiracy and, you know, second degree murder, so on and so forth. And an under felony murder is actually saying that as a result of that robbery, a death occurred. We don't believe that he had the intent to kill. Right. And that's what second degree murder is here in Pennsylvania.
Well, there's certain enumerated felonies, one of which is robbery. And if you, during a robbery, if a murder occurs, that becomes felony murder, which is, unfortunately, in Pennsylvania, even if you're convicted of second degree murder, it's life.
Troy, can you describe for us that awful, and probably, I mean, I'm guessing must have been the worst moment of your life when the jury came back in and found you guilty?
He said guilty. It was like, I was just like shocked. It was so shocking to me that the first couple of years, it really weighed on me mentally. And, you know, I lost a lot of family. My mother died, my grandmother died, my grandfather died. Just a domino of effect of pain and one after another. But I just couldn't believe it. And here we are 31 years later.
This episode is underwritten by Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton & Garrison, a leading international law firm. Paul Weiss has long had an unwavering commitment to providing impactful pro bono legal assistance to the most vulnerable members of our society and in support of the public interest, including extensive work in the criminal justice area.
First, I have to give all praise to our Creator, getting me through this and constantly having that hope that, you know, it will come to an end. However, it was a time, and actually, to be honest with you, it was just recently when they said I was negative, but I know I was positive. I was in the infirmary with COVID, and I was deadly sick. I never, ever felt no pain like that. And at that time, and this was months ago, I prayed and I asked the Lord, I said, if this is... I'd rather go now and don't even do this no more. Just if you feel I wasn't, you know, suicidal, but I was okay with dying. I just prayed, like, if this is the time and I'm not going to go home, I'm rather dying. And that was my prayer. And subsequently, you know, all this happened. It restored a little hope for me. But yeah.
You know, you're inspiring other people not to give up hope. So I'm glad you're here to talk about this, and I'm glad you're fighting. And I think now in Pennsylvania, there's, you know, the progress, and that should give hope to hopefully to you and many, many other people who need relief in the Pennsylvania criminal system. Talk a little about the post-conviction litigation, because this is a crazy, I mean, like a lot of these cases are when they go on this long. I mean, it should have been reversed. He should have been freed back in 93.
That conspiracy conviction in 1993 has since been reversed by the Superior Court of Pennsylvania. That in and of itself was a reason to overturn this case and retry me or to let me, you know, let me go. However, that hasn't been the case.
Which is just insane to me. Without the conspiracy and being in Atlantic City, how are you involved in the murder in any degree? Well, they continue to square that circle with the two bogus witnesses, Arthur Sanders saying you were in the car and Darren Johnson saying that you confessed to having to, quote, lay somebody down over some drugs. So in 1998, Darren Johnson wanted to come clean and finally recanted, and he did so in an affidavit. But as we find out later, he and his mother were threatened repeatedly by the police, and the prosecutor openly threatened him with perjury. So when he came to court in 1998 to affirm his recantation, he pleaded the fifth. Obviously, he would not have needed to plead the fifth if he was just going to repeat his bogus testimony. So Troy does most of his post-conviction litigation pro se, meaning by himself from his prison, acting as his own lawyer, trying to undermine Darren Johnson's trial testimony by proving that he had been incentivized by a deal for leniency in his own drug charges and that the defense had never been notified about any such deals.
When Darren, he was asked by the prosecutor, David Desiderio, do you have any open cases at this time? Darren Keith Johnson said, yes, one, 5 years probation. That's a direct quote, notes of testimony, page 337. However, unbeknownst to us, that was a lie. I mean, all his criminal history, he never has been on 5 years probation. The jury is listening to this. The jury say, oh, okay, he has 5 years probation. Okay, so he don't have any incentive to testify falsely against this guy because he's already been sentenced. Again, unbeknownst to us, that was a lie. Darren actually had open case at that time, which was resolved 69 days after I got convicted.
But unfortunately, so far, post-conviction litigation on this matter has been totally ignored. The court sided with the DA, finding him more credible than Darren Johnson. However, that's not the last we're going to hear from Darren Johnson. But first, 2009, you find out what I had mentioned earlier, that your investigator at the time of trial lied to you about not being able to find any alibi evidence in AC, and your alibi witness, Richard Crawford, being unwilling to testify, but you hired another private investigator later on, Walter P. Lee, and in 2009, he finally caught up with Richard Crawford.
When my private investigator, Walter Lee, went to go interview Richard Crawford, he said that's something that he never said to Ed Geyer. Said no one never came to see me and told me nothing about Troy. I was with him in Atlantic City, and I would have said I was with him in Atlantic City, and we have his statement now, but he said that never happened. So that in and of itself was problematic for me, but now Richard is willing to testify. And this is something that's also significant. Richard Crawford called from the hotel. He called home to his wife, Sherelle. The prosecutor had the phone numbers and those phone calls, and a couple of the phone calls was to Richard Crawford's address on McMahon Street in Philadelphia. They never turned that stuff over.
So now the evidence is mounting, and Darren Johnson recants, and they don't want to hear it. Your investigator, Walter Lee, unearths your alibi witness, shedding even more light on the state's misdeeds in this case, hiding that exculpatory evidence and ambushing you with it to undermine the truth, which was what they had already known, which is that you were in Atlantic City, not Philadelphia. However, if that alibi evidence wasn't enough for them to stop pursuing you in 1990, why would it stop them in 1998 or 2009 or ever? So another 10 years go past, and Byron Johnson, who everyone was rightfully scared of and wouldn't think of snitching on in 2019, had suffered a non-fatal gunshot wound. And I guess he didn't want to die without having told the truth. So he finally came forward, but oddly enough, he was shot and killed the following year on Juneteenth, 2020.
The person who was actually in the car, in the passenger seat of the car, Byron Johnson, has confessed to this in 2019. He did come and he confessed to the crime of disposing of the body, helping Kareem, and everything else. And he was always a prime suspect who was never arrested.
And there was a fellow named Herb Hardison who was with Byron Johnson, who had just been shot. And he got in touch with this fellow Hardison, and he said, get me to somebody because I want to be able to tell the truth about this before I die. And he knew that the end was near for him, and he wanted to do the right thing here. And he came and he gave a statement. Hardison, I interviewed him, took a statement from him. Walter Lee took the statement from Byron Johnson. Byron came in. He said that Kareem Nobles called him. He said something about moving some furniture or something like that. And he went over and he saw the dead body. Kareem said, look, you help me get rid of this body, I'll give you $5,000. And Byron goes, okay. I mean, that's easy money. All he's got to do is put the body in a car and drive away and leave the car out in Abington at the John Wanamaker store, which they did.
Byron Johnson was actually a prime suspect in this case. And actually, Darren Keith Johnson, as he was interviewed by Jerome and others, he made it clear that the reason why they got Darren to testify against me is because when I was in California, they believed that I was going to come back and tell everything that happened. Watch, I didn't know enough to tell, and he said that Byron, you know, put him up.
Byron Johnson was a very, very violent guy. As Darren said in his things, he was good with his fist, with knives, and with guns, and he was scared to death of Byron's reaction if he were to rat him out. So I think that he was finally comfortable enough to come forward, which is newly discovered evidence. He was unwilling to state until after Byron died. And he said the same thing that Byron said in his statement, which was that Nobles called him, got him to help him move the body. Byron and Darren Johnson essentially corroborate each other as to what happened here. And so do the police, because the police believe that Kareem Nobles was involved.
So the two men in the gray Dodge that Sanders allegedly saw were Kareem Nobles and Byron Johnson. Byron's confession and Darren's recantation impeached Sanders' shaky ID. The cops knew Kareem was involved, and perhaps the Joneses did too, since he wound up dead before the police had a chance to nab him. This murder happened in Troy's apartment while he was partying in AC. Other than letting his friends use his apartment while he was out of town, there was literally nothing else that connected Troy to this crime.
Troy, you know, there's no evidence that he was ever involved in any violent crimes. The one time he got arrested after, when he was stopped, what did they find on him? Marijuana. No guns, no nothing. You can be sure that he was stopped because he was driving while black in Philadelphia. So they would have searched the hell out of that car, and that's what they found.
And I want to just read a quick quote here from Darren Johnson, because it's one thing for us to talk about this one said this and the other one said that, but this is from an affidavit on September 3rd, 2020 that he courageously signed. And he said, quote, "Before the trial, the police kept trying to get me to come to court, and I really didn't want to. I knew my testimony was a lie. They and the prosecutor just told me to follow the script. They even went to my mother's house and harassed her and threatened her and told her to tell me to come back to court or something would happen to both of us. That's why in 1998 and 1999, I tried to testify, but again was threatened and I chickened out because I was told that I would go to jail for several years for perjury. I was still frightened because I was small. The public defender they gave to me that day told me to plead the fifth, and I did. Not only was I small, but I only had an eighth grade education, was a whole lot less smart than I am now. I regret then not having the courage to go through with telling the truth." He goes on to say, still quoting, "Someone might say that I'm angry with the police and the district attorney because they promised me that I probably wouldn't go to jail, and then I did. That is not the truth. I keep coming back, and I'm willing to testify because I know this is the truth, and this lie I told at Troy's trial has been bothering me for three decades. No matter what anyone threatens me with now, I'm not going to cave in. I should have done this years ago and told the truth about Byron, but I was afraid he would kill me or have me killed. I would like the opportunity for the court to see me in person and know what is in my heart, that Troy Coleman is not guilty." End quote.
Other than the testimony of these two people, there's not one shred of physical evidence that ties Troy Coleman to this crime. Nothing.
And to hear the words I just read from Darren Johnson and add that to Byron Johnson's confession where he admits to being the passenger in the car, does Arthur Sanders' shaky ID even matter anymore? I mean, the guy who would actually be in the gray Dodge told us it does not. But if that somehow is still not enough for you, consider some of the things that are known about Arthur Sanders. He began with not knowing Troy Coleman at all, then switched to he knew him from around the neighborhood. More importantly, he had Kevin Jones's pager and keys in his possession when Kevin went missing. To be in possession of a missing dead guy's things, you're going to want to place blame on someone else quickly. So let's say Sanders actually did see these two guys in the passing gray Dodge. I've been saying allegedly this entire time, as you might have noticed, but let's just suppose for a second that it actually happened that way. Troy and Myron do resemble one another. Now, let me be clear. I'm not just some random white dude giving cross-racial misidentification. Troy can back me up here. Troy, that tracks, right?
Yes, I will say that. Myron Johnson, definitely, yes.
Now, you two don't look exactly alike, but enough to say they look like one another, and that's why you're staring, right? Let alone while if one were to see a guy in a passing car behind glass at 20 miles an hour for less than 3 seconds. That's if we even accept that this passing gray Dodge identification actually happened. It's also entirely possible that this was a fabrication to steer the investigation and the Joneses away from Sanders and at least in the direction of Kareem and Byron. So that said, Jerry, where does this case stand now?
Currently, I have a motion for discovery that's still open. I think I filed a supplemental in April that's still open. The Commonwealth was going to respond to both of them, and I think that's where we're at right now. From my perspective, the system has to play out itself. I think that they're so busy in the CIU, which is a conviction integrity unit, that they are just overwhelmed. They have 1,400 cases, and they've got 6 or 8. Maybe 10 people working on them. They're all homicides.
Well, we've been seeing some really great things out of the Philadelphia CIU. Patricia Cummings, Larry Krasner. We know they're going to keep up the hard work. I mean, just think if you had to research and relitigate the last 30 to 50 years of corrupt cases in a place like Philly, Chicago, New Orleans, trying to right those wrongs is no easy task. So your hard work is not going unappreciated here. Maybe us shining a light on a case like Troy's will help bring it to the top of their very formidable pile.
God willing.
So after hearing all of this, Troy, I know I want to do all that I can, and I'm sure our audience feels the same way. Is there anything that they can do?
If you want to know more about my case, go to troycolemancase.com. Everything from the confession to the conspiracy being reversed to the recant testimony of Derrick E. Johnson to his deal that he received. Go to troycolemancase.com to see it for yourself.
Well, we'll definitely link your site in the episode bio. And with that, we now go to my favorite part of the show, where I first of all thank both of you so much for joining me here and sharing your story. And now I'm going to kick back in my chair, turn off my microphone, and just listen to whatever else you'd like to say. No offense, Jerry, but we'll be saving the best for last, our guest of honor, which means you'll be leading off.
Well, thank you, Jason, for giving me this opportunity to address Troy's case. Obviously, there is a lot of facts and circumstances here that are extremely troubling. One of the problems is back when Troy was arrested, Philadelphia was in the midst of one of its worst homicide waves in its history. Troy was also dealing with a secondary problem in that he had a court-appointed counsel. He was also dealing with homicide police that wanted to clear cases and do it in the most convenient way because they were being pressured to do so. And therefore, they used, some of the cases I've seen, some shortcuts in order to achieve that goal. And one of the shortcuts is that they would pressure witnesses. And in this case, they had two very good subjects that they could pressurize. So these are the only two pieces of evidence that were the backbone and the heart and soul of the Commonwealth's case. Once they've been debunked, which I believe they have been, and there's been new evidence that's come forward from Byron Johnson, who said that Kareem Nobles told him that he was the shooter and asked him to help him dispose of the body. Johnson, unfortunately, is dead, but he's kind of taken the wraps off of Darren Johnson because he was scared to death of this man who was extremely violent, and that's why he died a violent death. But anyway, once these pieces have been debunked, it is pretty clear that Troy Coleman is not guilty.
All right, Troy, over to you.
I would like to thank everyone for allowing me to have this opportunity. And at this time, I would like to say, Alhamdulillah, Rabbi, I mean, all praise is due to our Lord. I don't think anything is going to come to fruition in regards to this case except by the will of our Creator, God, the Most High. I would like to thank Jason and my attorney and Connor and all that was involved in this, my family, who has been supporting me through this. And my message, or I like to have a takeaway, even if, you know, it's just not about me, but, you know, at this time, what got me through these years, and I want to encourage a lot of the youth, because we're actually going through a lot with our youth today, with a lot of killing and crime and all that, is I want to push education and vocational skills that's needed. I'm a founder and facilitator of a group entitled YOOSE, which the acronym is Young Offenders Understanding the Habitual Shackles, which is facilitated by myself, Kevin Bowman, and Tracy Watts. And we push forward to try to help the youth from between ages of 18 and 30 with this enhancing and or honing their education and vocational skills. I would also like to, lastly, thank FCI Chester, which is one of the most progressive jails right now for criminal justice reform. And at this institution, we have more guys who went out on commutation. And I would like to also note that I did file for commutation under actual innocence. Perchance this will fall on deaf ears. God willing, it won't. But this jail has been good for, and they allowed me to do this podcast, and I'm very grateful for that. And I hope that other institutions can mirror what's going on at our institution here. So I would like to thank Task Superintendent Ms. Lamas, and Superintendent Eason and W. Wall, because these are some of our progressives here that, you know, push for education and vocation and allowing, you know, college courses and stuff that goes on here that is not done in other jails. But I'm very grateful for everyone, and God willing, I can be speaking further about this on the street as opposed to, you know, from the penitentiary, God willing. And I thank you all.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Please support your local innocence projects and go to the link in our bio to see how you can help. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Wardis. The music on the show, as always, is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.